one, counting two, counting three, counting four, counting five, six, seven.
She didn't hear.
Eight. Did you not hear that you're up, Mary? Because I was just about ready to kill your bill. You're up. You're on. Step up to the plate. Batter up. And I was actually speaking louder than I normally do, so it's too early in the session to do the 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, your bill's dead. So.
I didn't want to play that game.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Mary Bach, and I'm with the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. I'd like to start by apologizing for not hearing the chair call our bill or my name. We're here today to speak in favor of Senate Bill 620, and with me is Dwayne Skinner, who works in our transport unit for the Department of Corrections, and Tim Woolery, who is one of our officers over at Santa Yam. You know, it's always going to be the release center for me, but anyway, and this bill is really pretty straightforward. It requires that when an officer is charged with any kind of issue around use of force within the Department of Corrections, once they have been found to not be at fault or to be relieved, or when they have attorney's fees, that once they've been found innocent, that those attorney's fees will be reimbursed by the state. And so with that, I'm going to let the officers tell you about it because they actually know more about this issue than I do, and for me to talk is redundant.
All right, good. If you just introduce yourself for the record and then proceed. I'm not sure who's going to start. But
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Dwayne Skinner. Been employed with the Department of Corrections for 17 years. This issue arose about 4 years ago through training with the state police, and the investigator at that time was Sergeant Gower, and he advised us at that time that we needed to accrue a contract language or something along the lines to protect ourselves in criminal investigations. Officer-involved shootings or lethal force issues are automatically criminally investigated. Evidence is taken, blood urine samples, and he said that it would be well advised to enter into those investigations with legal counsel. And that brought us here today. The Attorney General's office cannot represent us as state employees under them circumstances because they could potentially end up being part of the investigation or the prosecution. They represent us in civil matters only after we've been exonerated and proven that our actions were honorable. The packet that I'm presenting has exhibits from Jeff Van Valkenburg, the Assistant Attorney General, facts from Dale Penn on his procedures when the foreign officer involved shooting incident, the Department of Corrections policy on officer involved shootings, a training document from Sergeant Gower, and a collective bargaining agreement between the City of Portland and the Portland Police Association.
Is that a packet that you have for us?
Yes, sir.
I don't know that we have it. Now, let me ask counsel, Mr. Taylor, have you reviewed the issues around the Garrity case and how Garrity plays into representation during use of force inquiries?
I can do it, though. I can do it.
Yeah, we may want to because it's a fairly key case. And, I only know that having investigated officer-involved shootings before, dealt with the right to counsel issues. So.
Okay.
You want to proceed then? You've got your packets in front of us, so maybe you can...
Yeah, man. That's pretty much the end of it. I just wanted to go over the testimony you're involved in. Thank you for giving me this time. And
All right. And what is the central issue that we're trying to fix in the statute change?
At large, that these fees would be reimbursed to the officer after exonerated and shown that their actions were honorable, that if there's false allegations toward the officer from an inmate, and afterwards proven that he was not negligent in any way.
Do you know whether or not Mr. Penn takes these incidents to a grand jury in every instance?
More times than not. He prefers it to be determined by your peers that you're exonerated.
And why is the Portland Police Association contract language present here?
I put that there so that you would know we're not asking for something that isn't out there, that it's not something new. The Sheriff's Association has a collective bargaining agreement as well. The Portland Police Association language was referred to me by Leonard Williamson about 4 years ago when I was researching this, and he said that their language was probably the best in the state, so that's what this bill was kind of...
Well, and that has arisen as a matter of collective bargaining, and this is a statutory change, so why don't we have a little dialogue about why not collective bargaining?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do not feel like it is appropriate for public safety officials to be protected only based on what they've been able to kind of get at the bargaining table under these circumstances, but rather that we have a uniform policy across the state that when you work for a public safety agency and you are called upon to, in some cases, use deadly force and that there's an ensuing investigation, that officer, once they've been exonerated, if there's a question about the appropriateness of their actions, once they have been exonerated of any wrongdoing, that their attorney's fees be reimbursed. The problem is that the officer is always forced to hire an attorney in that environment to represent them. And so they don't have a lot of choices in front of them. And I think that Mr. Woolery can give us some background about some changes within the Department of Corrections that's kind of moved this up to a front burner issue for our members that work in the department.
Well, Mary, before we go ahead, you represent, and AFSCME represents these individuals in their employment,
right?
Correct. Has your organization tried to negotiate or bargain for a provision in their contract similar to what the association has?
I believe they have, and I believe it is it's within the bargaining proposals being considered this time as well. But again, I don't. It seems to me that this is a public policy issue. It's bigger than just a collective bargaining agreement, and not every public safety official in Oregon is covered by a collective bargaining agreement. And it seems to us that what's good policy for one group ought to be good policy for the whole group, and regardless of who they work for. And, to be really straight about it, I think that, even the non-represented employees need to have some protection as well. Senator Minnis, as well as I do that in this field of duty, you're dealing with people who are not always truthful, honest, and trustworthy.
Talking about who?
The other side of the... the ones who aren't in uniform, the ones who don't get to go home at night.
Right.
Officers are often find themselves forced to defend themselves against inmate charges, and sometimes inmate charges are just, levied for sport. And quite honestly, it costs our officers a lot to defend themselves against some of these frivolous cases that we find ourselves defending ourselves
against.
All right.
So are we talking about use of force issues,
yes,
or are we talking about other kinds of complaints?
At this point, we're talking just about use of force.
All right. Senator Walker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I need some help in understanding the procedure. Mr. Skinner alluded to it, but I guess I don't follow. So if someone, an inmate, makes a complaint against an officer for excessive use of force, what happens after that? You indicated that in response to the chair's question that it doesn't always go to the DA, that it's decided by your peers. So could you explain to me the process and why it is that you have to hire an attorney?
Dwayne Skinner again. And if there's allegations of excessive use of force within the facilities, it goes before an internal review. And it could accelerate up to and including charges being filed. And at that time, through the interview process, you would want legal counsel. And especially if it was, I mean, if it's erroneous allegations against you, you could potentially, through civil suit, lose everything. So, I mean, mistakes that are involved, you wouldn't want to enter into that investigation without legal counsel.
And then I have a second question, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm.
How often does this happen? Is this a frequent allegation of inmates?
No, ma'am. It's infrequent, but there's been two or three incidents that I'm aware of over 17 years of experience that actually went through the process. The officers were exonerated, and they were out of pocket for extensive legal fees.
Okay, that helps me a great deal. Thank you.
Well, and let me also understand, I think Senator Walker's question is a good one. The Portland Police Association, Article 52, dealing with legal fees, is specific to criminal charges or criminal investigations as opposed to those administrative investigations. So I want to make sure, is that what we're talking about here, criminal investigations or criminal charges, as opposed to something that's handled through an internal investigative process?
Yes.
And what's the internal process in the Department of Corrections? Is it the Inspector General, or who does that?
For
like in my agency, it's the Internal Affairs, IA, handles that. Mm-hmm. How do you do it?
Yeah, we have Internal Affairs as well.
You do, okay.
And they're fact finders, and they report that information to our administrators.
Let me ask you this, because I know the policies within the Portland Police Bureau are such that if there are criminal charges, or potential criminal charges, the criminal investigation is handled before the internal affairs investigation occurs.
Correct.
Is that the same in the Department of Corrections?
Yes, sir.
It is. Okay.
If criminal charges are pending or potential of, that investigation is completed prior to the administrative or internal.
So if you are subject to allegations that you committed a crime, as a matter of employment, assuming one of the inmates is alleging this, then who investigates that criminal allegation? Is it the Oregon State Police, or do you have your own?
The criminal investigation will be conducted by the Oregon State Police.
All right. And then once you go through that process, you're exonerated either by the investigator, I assume, or it goes to a grand jury and you find that they're not true, Bill.
It could be exonerated by the investigator, or it could end up with the district attorney, and it would be up to his policy where we are in the state to...
Okay. I want to make sure we're talking about similar processes. Senator Burdick?
So, Chairman, this was a long time ago, but when I was covering corrections as a reporter a number of years ago, the state police could actually get involved if they requested a warden where they felt there was a case where an independent review was necessary. Is it, you know, at what point do you have this kind of outside agency coming in to kind of say yay or nay on some of these charges?
Depending on the charge, if it has the potential of being a criminal charges filed, it would automatically go to the state police. Our internal affairs, whatever, does not handle criminal investigations.
Okay, so just the potential for a criminal.
Yeah, if they believe it could turn into criminal charges, they would hand it over to the state police.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, in practice, when the state police comes in and finds that there's no no reason to pursue it, in practice, does that pretty much end it?
Possibly. It could be administratively determined that you had some negligence and you could be administratively sanctioned. But the criminal side of it would be done if the state police had dropped the case and found that there was no criminal charges.
Okay, so Mr. Chairman, are you saying that even while the state police, in the state police phase, that people need a lawyer at that point, or do they only need it if it goes beyond the point of the state police investigation?
What brought this about was actually the officer-involved shooting incident, because that's automatically a criminal investigation, and evidence is taken from you at the time, everything you're wearing, photos. Within 24 hours the state police request, they sit down, extensive interview, and at that time we were advised that we should do that with legal counsel up to and including the grand jury phase, and if exonerated at grand jury, that would be the end of your legal, the time that you retain your legal counsel.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I read this still to also, I mean, obviously officer-involved shootings is an extreme example. It's an automatic criminal thing.
Mm-hmm.
But if you had, say, a prisoner in the psychiatric ward, for example, who was complaining about ill treatment or whatever, and it reached a level where state police were called in, that's not as extreme as an officer-involved shooting. If the state police were involved in a scenario like that, would they feel the need to get counsel in that scenario?
Not so much through the investigation process, because that could be not necessarily geared toward the officer, but if you're being read your Miranda rights and the investigation is being geared toward you, you'd be well advised to have legal counsel. And should, with this bill, if it's found that you were negligent and you were outside the scope of your employment, the state would not be liable for the attorney fees. It would be on the officer that was negligent. The only time the state would be liable would be if exonerated and found that the charges brought forth against the officer were unfounded and they were found innocent of them.
So would it be helpful if one more question?
Sure, you bet.
If this were narrowed down to only cover the scenario of officer-involved shootings, would that be a, since that was the incident that provoked this, would that be a useful bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, my only concern with that is that more and more we have what we call extraction teams for cell extractions, and more our extraction teams are being called on by other law enforcement agencies to assist in the proper control of out of control inmates. Okay, whether they're in county jails or city jails or the state facilities. And you could have a situation where excessive force would be the issue. And, you know, when you watch a cell extraction, if you watch the tapes of a cell extraction, sometimes it may seem to a layperson that there is more force being used than what is actually than what is actually occurring. And, you know, I understand the desire to kind of narrow the focus to officer-involved shootings, but I think that there are some excessive force issues, and those probably are more likely to occur than actual shootings with our folks. You know, corrections officers aren't armed in the institution, and so the likelihood of them shooting somebody is unlikely. Now, Mr. Skinner is armed because he's part of the transport team that actually moves inmates from one place to another, and the tower officers are armed, and they could be involved in a shooting. But in most cases, it would be the question would be excessive force issues. And so we'd want to be sure that those issues were covered as well.
Although, Mary, excessive force is something that would be handled in an internal affairs or internal investigation as opposed to assault, which is a criminal charge.
I understand that.
Okay. Listen, I need to do something here. There's a witness that needs to be on before 9 o'clock, and I want to transition right now. Sir, I'll bring you back to talk about the bill, but I'm going to close the public hearing on 6:20 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 611 so I can get the witness on.
I understand.
Get out of here. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Meantime, I'd like Mr. Taylor to go hunt up the Garrity decision, if you would, and other statutes relevant to use of force, just to throw that together real quick so the committee has it. You don't need any legal interpretations, just the references would be nice. And sure, so we can read it. Close the public hearing on 6:20, open the public hearing on 6:11. Cindy, Robert, and you have a gentleman to come up with you, is that correct? I do want everyone to know how sensitive the chair is today. I made accommodations for Ms. Robert because of child care issues, and I also brought donuts to the committee.
I appreciate that.
You expect
that
to be treated nicely.
It should be. I had a tire blood on the way home last night, too, so it's been very difficult for hours. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert. I represent the American Institute of Architects. With me today is John Baker. John is on the board of directors for AIA Oregon. He is a regional director for AIA. He is an architect, and he is an attorney. So he's joining me to answer some questions. You have before you Senate Bill 611, and I've had the opportunity, along with Marshall Koba, to speak to most of you, all of you, actually, about this bill. We started out with one version of the bill, and we ended up with something else from some direction from all of you. It's been very helpful. One of the questions that was asked when I was talking to all of you about this bill is, where else can you find a certificate of merit bill? There's six other states. Attached in the packet that I just gave you is the statute from those six other states. Senator Walker asked me not only to provide her with information on what other states had the certificate of merit, but how it was going. So I posed that question on the state government network, which the architects had, and you'll see that I have two responses there from, I believe it was Colorado and Arizona. Senate Bill 611 places on people trying to sue architects and engineers the need for their attorney to certify that he has, in fact, done his due diligence. All of you know that that is part of Oregon civil procedure now. This is nothing new. It puts it into statute so it's more thoroughly enforced. That's all there is to this. People are here to oppose it. I can't figure out why. It's something that we're already requiring people to do. Due diligence, you have to have consulted people to make sure that your lawsuit has some merit. In our case, with architects and engineers, where a lot of what we do is more in the gray area, not black and white as far as did you build some steps, did they fall down, that kind of liability issue. Ours is more gray, so we find that we often have people, including us in lawsuits, when there's no reason to. So we're simply asking for an attorney to certify that he has, in fact, done that due diligence that is required and has, in fact, made sure that there's someone in the same design profession that thinks that the standard of care has been breached. It was brought to my attention this morning that some paperwork issues may be difficult with this, as far as multiple affidavits being filed, more needs for notary, et cetera, et cetera. This bill could actually be changed if that is a major concern of this committee. This bill could be changed so that not an affidavit was required, but just certification within the original plea, complaint. Certification signed in the original complaint would keep paperwork issues down and would, again, only emphasize what is already civil procedure. We just want it to be enforced.
All right. Great. Mr. Baylor?
Thank you. I think Cindy's wrapped it up and asked me to come down here mostly to answer questions, but I think the important point to understand about the bill is that it doesn't change the design professional's liability to the public. It doesn't change their responsibility to the public in any way. It simply changes and doesn't really change the mechanism by which design professionals are supposed to answer to calls on that public responsibility for their harm. Unfortunately, in reality, design professionals are generally brought into lawsuits that have a number of other parties. If there is a problem with a construction project, there will be contractors, there will be subcontractors, and the design professional tends to be brought in as a matter of course. The rules of civil procedure at this point allow the design professional to get out of those cases based upon by filing a motion to have the case dismissed on the pleadings and on the facts, and if the plaintiff doesn't come up with an affidavit stating the sorts of things that this certification bill requires, that then the architect will be entitled to a dismissal. In my experience, that costs between $10,000 and $20,000 each time that exercise has to be gone through, partly for the reason that very often the parties bringing the design professionals in are insurance defense attorneys who are not familiar with professional standard of care, are not familiar with how this works, and tend to bring the design professionals in at the direction of the insurance company that they represent, and are not, in the last case that I was involved in, were not allowed to grant a dismissal when we demanded that they dismiss because they were instructed by the insurance company not to dismiss us. We're some $26,000 into that case. We finally got the court to dismiss the case, and we're going after the insurance company in that particular case for sanctions. But it costs a lot of money. It's taken 6 months. It has completely exhausted that design professional's deductible on the policy. The design professionals pay these deductibles out of pocket. This bill would make it clear at the outset, would put all attorneys and parties that would make claims against design professionals on notice of what the standards are that they need to meet before they make a claim against a design professional and choose to use litigation as a forum to sort out and for discovery. We've attempted to craft it so that it doesn't place any additional burden other than is there, but simply make a quicker and more direct route at which to test the pleading at the outset for sufficiency with respect to having done the due diligence that the party is actually obligated to do under the Oregon rules. As Cindy pointed out, the original draft that we provided, and I believe it was probably changed by legislative counsel, did not provide for an additional affidavit, but the draft language we provided simply provided that there had to be the specific certification, which would presumably be included within the pleading or attached to the pleading, a specific certification that the due diligence had been done and that there was some basis, not a winning case, but that the person filing the suit had a basis in fact before they made a claim against the design professional. This is what we're here asking for.
Mr. Chair, if I might add really quickly, on the first bill sheet on the packet I gave you, Senate Bill 611, there are footnotes on that entire bill that show you where the stipulations within each section comes from so that you can refer to Oregon Civil Procedure and see that this is already part of the court rules.
All right. So, Senator Burdick, question?
Thank you. You make reference to action cases being dismissed because it's found that you don't have you don't belong in the case. In that case, do they just get you out of the case or do they dismiss the whole thing? So the person might have a cause of action if their building falls down or whatever, and it's determined that the design professional doesn't belong in there, so they dismiss. In those cases, is that the end of the case and the people who are responsible get off as well?
No. In most cases, it's not. Part of the difficulty is that the standard that's applied to a contractor for breach of contract, the types of proof and the types of evidence and the standard of care of the contractor there, where there is no standard of care, the contractor is responsible to do what it promised to do under the contract. Then there's a standard of care for simple negligence, which would apply to people that had performed their work negligently and caused the damage, is a different standard of care than the standard of care that an architect or a design professional has. When the architect or design professional is released from the case because the plaintiff party has not established a reason to presume or a reason to have them in, the case goes on. very seldom is there a case in which there is only the design professional involved. It's usually a far more complicated
issue. I understand. I'm clear from your comments. Thank you.
All right. Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Good morning. Thanks for coming in. I was just going to mention that early this session, Ms. Roberts brought this bill to me together with Marshall Cove, and originally it did include a requirement that the full report would be attached, and I said that would be a huge leap in the requirements to file a lawsuit, and I would be adamantly opposed to that, and I suggested that perhaps they ought to try the route of an affidavit, and I discussed this morning with them what my thoughts were on that, and part of the, frankly, I don't know that in some context it's that unreasonable, and frankly, I do think to the extent that lawyers file lawsuits without having the necessary proof, it is an abuse of the system, and it reflects poorly on the profession. But I note that in the materials you provided for the Certificate of Merit laws, there's a long list of professions that apparently this applies to in other states, from veterinarians to podiatrists to dietitians. And I guess is what I'm wondering is whether really this is the first step in requiring this type of certification for all those professions, or whether there is something special and unique about your profession that where we might justify it in your profession and say, okay, but we don't want to go further. And so that we know next session when the other 23 professions are here saying, okay, we want what the architects got,
right.
What are we supposed to tell them?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, good point. You're looking at the Colorado law, the Certificate of Merit there, it deals with most professionals.
Mm-hmm.
When Senator Walker asked about who had Certificate of Merit, I didn't look for ones that were specific to architects and engineers, but rather anyone who had Certificate of Merit. You'll find that there's other bills in here or statute in here for other states that are specific to the design professional, but not Colorado. Theirs is much broader. I will tell you that last session, the engineers came to the legislature with a bill that did a Certificate of Merit. This started on the House side. And the problem was is it was written so broadly that all these people wanted in. But what I did this time when I drafted the language is I found a different place for it. And by putting it into the statute that I put it into, which is ORS 30-point-something, now I don't see it here, but that section of statute is already specific to the architect and engineer and lawsuits against the architect and engineer. So I'm not going into statute having to do a civil procedure for all professionals and saying, oh, and this part here only applies to architects and engineers. In fact, I'm starting from statute that only refers to architects and engineers and just adding on to that. So that is how I tried to avoid the problem of everyone now coming to you and saying, do this for us. They can fight their own battle. I'm just fighting mine.
Well, isn't one of the arguments, and kind of join in this discussion with architects and engineers, don't you generally work around a set of rules like the Oregon, the building codes, uniform building codes or national standards that kind of are what they are, as opposed to, you take legal practice or medical practice, mm-hmm. there are different procedures and different interpretations, which it seemed to me that it would be easier to have some kind of an affirmation by a professional who says, I'm willing to come in and testify that this particular architect or engineer did not comply with the Uniform Building Codes or national standards, et cetera, as opposed to an attorney who might come in and say, well, you know, if I was in that attorney's position, I might have done exactly the same thing, but I'm not really sure, and I'm not sure I'm going to be there, or a physician who might likewise say something like that. So I don't know if that works or not.
Well, I guess, Mr. Chair, my thought was maybe there's something about this profession that makes it particularly susceptible to abuse in terms of filing a lawsuit without having an opinion. I mean, a lawyer, in alleging any type of professional malpractice, ought to have an opinion before the lawsuit is filed, at least in his own files.
Right.
And I'm just wondering whether you think there's anything about architects and engineers where it is more abused, where a lawyer might file a lawsuit without having that opinion.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ringo, you'll see that I attached to your packet a study that was done on professional liability claims against architects and engineers. The study was done quite some time ago. It was printed in 1995. There's been nothing more recent than that. I guess it's not an interesting topic for most people to do studies on, but it is there, and it does provide for you some of the reasons as to why we are subject to more frivolous lawsuits And as Mr. Baker pointed out, a lot of that has to do with people not understanding the realm within which we work and the standard of care that we do proceed under.
Yes, if I can pick up on that. Part of the problem is that what architects, engineers, and design professionals do is a service. It's similar to what a lawyer does, but unfortunately, the mistakes that architects or engineers might make or might be thought to have made usually lead to very large and very complicated results. And what happens is because of the lack of understanding of what the design professional does and how the design professional standard of care operates, that the design professional is brought in to a bunch of into very technical and very, very complex lawsuits in which its relationship to the damages is very hard to establish. It would be similar to probably to if lawyers had a problem with being sued for construction defects on the basis of the kinds of contracts that they entered into and suddenly find themselves in there defending along with a bunch of contractors and subcontractors for defects in the work. There is a particular lack of understanding of how the relationships work among the parties in the construction process, and it causes a lot of this ready, fire, aim type litigation in which everybody brings in and has a big happy party of litigation, which is very expensive to the profession. Architecture liability insurance is very difficult to get. Architects, for economic reasons, have to carry fairly large deductibles. Actual claims litigated against architects are very rare because the kinds of mistakes that are required to have insured coverage are really actually quite rare in comparison to the types of claims that are made against architects at the outset and the difficulties that the architect has at extracting himself from those claims when there are a lot of issues on the plate in court. Once again, this is intended to make it very clear to help both the judge and the parties that are going to make the claims to understand where the bar is going to be and to actually hopefully set the trigger, the ORCP 47 trigger, earlier so that question about whether there is in fact cause to bring the design professional into the litigation exists at a very early date, right at the time that the pleading is done, and not sometime later, some months later, which is what it typically takes to get through the motion practice part of the lawsuit.
Senator Riggle.
Well, now you have me a little more worried. If the goal is to discourage attorneys from filing lawsuits without having the proof in hand, I mean, that's one thing. If the goal is to make them put all the proof on the table so that it's subject to ORCP 47 analysis right off the bat, that's another thing.
Senator Ringo, I think that's a good question, but there's no more proof than what would be called for under Rule 17. ORCP 47, the summary judgment rules, essentially say if the attorney hasn't done the due diligence, you can call that attorney to task by filing a motion and requiring the attorney to give an affidavit. As I interpret that rule, if that attorney gets the affidavit and his affidavit says, I hired that guy yesterday, I presumably still have a claim against that attorney or that party for a Rule 17 violation for filing the suit without having done the due diligence, without making the inquiry. This simply calls the question as to whether the person has made the inquiry that the rules require them to make, calls the question earlier than having to put it out and bring it through motion practice, which is expensive and time-consuming. It doesn't really create any burden that is not already on the attorney. It simply causes that attorney to certify that it is in fact, or that party to certify that they have in fact met that burden before they file the complaint, or have made a good faith effort to meet that burden if they've got a statute problem.
Mr. Chair, I mean, I would be willing to look at this, but I frankly would want to scale back some of the requirements that we need to be placed in the affidavit. For example, when a lawsuit is filed, sometimes a plaintiff's attorney cannot have complete information as to what's happened. I mean, they only have a part of the picture. Now, that doesn't
let them out from doing their due diligence. But on the other hand, if facts develop and they learn more, I mean, they shouldn't be foreclosed from pursuing those broader options. And just for example, your on subsection 2, sub A, the statement would require the time, place, and circumstance of each allegedly negligent act or omission. I mean, to me, that's getting into a lot of detail that certainly sometime before the trial it would be appropriate to say, but I don't know that you really need to have that.
Well, Mr. I'm the chair. Excuse me. help me understand this, because my understanding is complaints are supposed to be factually based anyway. And I have to transition because I do criminal affidavits for search warrants and arrest warrants and this kind of thing. And when I do the affirmation, it's very different than a complaint in a civil lawsuit. But I generally have to state who I've spoken to and who is affirming that these facts are true, and time, place, location, descriptions, et cetera. Tell me how that's different.
And first of all, in federal court, which we're not exactly talking federal court here, but it could be construed as applying. In federal court, it's just notice pleading, which is just sufficient to put the defendant on notice of the general nature of the lawsuit, and then the details are fleshed out as it goes along. Now, in state court, it does require more specificity, but there's always a tension because the plaintiff would prefer to keep things a little more general, and the defense would prefer to narrow the scope of the pleadings a little bit so that it is more narrowed. But that's one of those gray areas. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of times where a lawsuit is filed in civil court and in state court where the pleadings are very general. And as the case goes along, sometimes there's motion practice that requires more specificity. Sometimes the judge will order that the plaintiff plead with more specificity, right. But it kind of depends on the lawsuit.
And if I understand correctly, Oregon used to have a standard when the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure that were very, or perhaps preceding those rules, that were very specific to these very facts, and then Oregon liberalized that complaint process. So this is taking it back a little bit more to the specificity. Arena.
One of the difficulties in translating our rules to other states is that other states have dramatically different pleading rules. I mean, they're modeled on the federal rules, and Oregon's are very different. And so I think it is a little bit problematic to say other states have this, so it ought to work just fine in Oregon.
Oh, but Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, we did not model this after the other states. Actually, John wrote this before seeing the other states, and I have since found out that National American Institute of Architects will actually use ours as a model if it passes, because it is so broad and is more easily adaptable to each state.
From my perspective, the goal should be to prevent attorneys or deter attorneys from filing a lawsuit when they haven't consulted with a professional. And that's some of the scenario you described and the gentleman with you described, where in the middle of trial they finally consulted for the very first time some expert. I mean, I think that's abhorrent, and those attorneys ought to be hammered. And so if the goal is to require that they at least have consulted with a professional before they file a lawsuit, I'm all for that. If the goal is to make them put all their cards on the table face up, which frankly is written, it pushes in that direction, that's where I have a problem.
Senator Ringo, let me understand what you're doing here. Would you want that affirmation in some form in the complaint file that they have, in fact?
Well, I think my friends at Oatlaw are probably going to slaughter me if I admit to go along with that. But frankly, I don't know that it's that unreasonable. But I guess I chafe at the further detail of all the allegations, the time, the date of the negligence, all that specific information is what I would be less willing to accept.
Okay, and then yes, go ahead.
I mean, maybe one approach to this would be, because I share some of these concerns, that if you're putting a different kind of playing field, and this is obviously I don't have the specialization that Senator Ringo does on these matters, but it would seem to me that if we could just get them to certify that they had consulted a professional who was competent in this area before including an architect, because as I read down this list of people who are covered by certificates of merit in other states, this list has people like nurses and veterinarians and accountants and people who you would be most likely, it seems to me, to sue individually. Mm-hmm. And what I hear you saying the problem is here is that you're being swept in to a case where people just want to cover all their bases and to make sure that if by chance there is a piece of the architect that was a problem in this building falling down, that they're covered, and you want to make sure that they have some basis for including you as opposed to just slipping you in an abundance of caution at great cost to you. Is that a correct
well said, Senator.
Assessment? And so if you even had a requirement that they make some showing that they attempted to find out the merits of, you know, by consulting with a professional, would that be helpful?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, yes, in fact, that is really what the purpose of this is to require that showing. And Senator Ringo's concerns to the extent of the specifics of the pleading requirements or the specifics of the language are well taken. And I think that it could be backed off or possibly even removed, although it seems to me that one of the problems with the lack of understanding of the particular issue of professional negligence and the standard of care that is required to be shown and has to be shown by an expert, that the consultation with the expert has got to be about something. The problem here is if you have the consultation that you have consulted with the expert about the standard of care, the breach of the standard of care, and the causation, because all of those are what require the expert testimony in order to make the case. Otherwise, what happens is you find that an attorney can go and find an expert and say, was this person negligent? In some respect, and the answer will be probably, if I look hard enough, I will find it. I mean, we all don't pay attention once in a while when we're backing out of our driveways and we're negligent. We just don't cause accidents every time we do that. And the question here is that in order to have a lawsuit, there has to be the professional negligence, which is going to have to be shown by expert testimony, but that professional negligence has to have caused some kind of harm that is being sued for, and that connection has got to be made and shown, and is a requirement on the summary judgment, and that is why the extra pleading requirements are in there, to make sure that the expert is actually asked a question that is pertinent to the lawsuit.
So, Mr. Chairman, this would not be necessary, as I understand it, if someone were to sue an architect individually, no other defendants, but sue an architect individually for some clear violation that they saw, and then, you know, that they felt they had a case against an architect without these other people. I don't know if those suits ever happen or whether they're always in conjunction with someone else.
Senator Burdick, it would apply as long as the architect was being sued for its professional work. I mean, this is not going to apply to suing an architect for general negligence or breach of contract. If the architect breaches a contract with a client, the client has a regular lawsuit. This only has to do with suing an architect in the same way that one would sue a doctor or a nurse or a lawyer for professional practice. The person can't know whether the architect or the engineer, there isn't any way of just saying that there is clearly professional negligence here without somebody looking at it and saying, no, I understand what a careful doctor is responsible to know or not to know. I understand what a careful architect should know or shouldn't know. It's not presumed. It's within understanding the profession, the standard of care within that profession. So anytime a person was being sued for breach of the standard of care, a professional standard of care under this bill, that certification would be required. That individual would be subject to the same dismissal under the rules as they are now if they hadn't done it, if they hadn't gotten this certification, but didn't have the expert on standby that had given them the opinion, once again, that this that this other architect's conduct failed to meet the standard of care and that that conduct caused the harm.
Yeah, and that's part of existing law.
And that will always be a part of a lawsuit on professional negligence.
All right, another question? There are none. Thank you. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Out of here before 9 o'clock. So
hopefully
make sure the duties. With that, we're going to take a 5-minute break. Donut break.
Donut break.
You want to come up and talk? You can come up and talk. Why don't you come up and talk? I'm not trying to be mean. I'm just going to try to expedite the issue a little bit. But probably a good idea to have your testimony on the record. So.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Richard Lane. I do represent the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and we've had a moment to confer during the break, and I'm happy to proceed if the chair would prefer, or I could come back another day, if that's the preference to the chair.
Well, Mr. Lane, my hope was that I could send everybody out in the hallway for a couple of weeks and see if you could come up with something that might work and Science Center and Ringo to kind of oversee that. Not that I'm expecting that there's a specific product that comes back, but just to see if there might be some compromise that would be doable.
Well, then, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I will leave my written testimony for the committee's review. I think it highlights some of the things that we discussed this morning, some of the concerns about the scope of what is requested in Senate Bill 611, the need for special classes being created that's been highlighted. I'd like to take a look at some of those certificates from the other state, and I plan on getting the information from, don't know her name, testified on behalf of the bill to see what those certificate looks like, and maybe we can come back to you with something that we would not be opposed to.
All right, good. Well, I think what I'm going to do with Senator Ringo's consent is just assign him as the hub of the wheel on this, along with Mr. Joseph, to see if there is a possibility for compromise. Again, there may not be, but at least we'll send you off and see if you can negotiate something. Is that
excellent.
Something you're willing to do?
Yes.
Okay. Any other member feeling compelled to participate in that?
I feel very comfortable.
All right. And we have one other individual out there who's raising her hand. You want to be participatory in this too? Cities do. All right.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I've asked both Richard and Cindy to consult with me on putting something together, and I ask anybody else out there who's interested to do that as well. And,
all right.
And I'll assist Senator Ringo. I'll probably actually start it and then get Senator Ringo involved.
All right. Anybody who wants to get on the act, Senator Ringo?
I guess I'd just like to make a point. I have not spoken with Mr. Lane about this in any length at all, but my sense is that OTLA is really uncomfortable with anything in this regard. And so one of our tasks then will be whether we should, there's something we can find that at least is somewhat palatable to them, that they could stand.
Well, I'm eternally hopeful that all parties can eventually come to some agreement.
Okay.
And we'd be happy to work with counsel and Senator Ringo and the other proponents.
Great. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. If there's anybody else who absolutely feels like they have to testify in 611, I'd give you the opportunity to do that.
You,
sir. Come on up.
Thank you, Senator. My name is James Marvin. I'm an attorney in Portland. I devoted a third of the century towards a representation of the design profession. I would like to be on the committee to work towards the compromise, and I'd ask Senator Ringo to put my name down, James Marvin.
Certainly.
Thank you,
Mr. Marvin.
Thank you very much, then, and we'll earnestly await.
Yeah.
I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 611. Thank you for your willingness to be flexible on the issue. We'll reopen a public hearing on Senate Bill 620.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
I think these coffee breaks are turning out to be quite advantageous. I just wanted to make a note of that.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate you guys coming back, by the way. All right. Mary, we left off
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, I'm Mary Bodkin with AFSCME Council 75. You know, this is always a good lesson in how laws are really made. We take a little adjournment here and find out there's a lot of unintended consequences with the bill as written. Let me say two things. Number one, we still think it's good policy to cover all public safety officials. Number two, it's not our job. You know, our job is to take care of the Department of Corrections and our folks who work there. And so we have, after consulting with some of the folks in the room and with legal counsel, we think that it makes sense to narrow the bill to cover only the Department of Corrections and to make it very, very clear that this will cover only use of force or officer-involved shooting issues. And we think that that gets to the crux of the problem and the concerns for our folks who are being called upon to interact daily with the criminal population in the prison system.
All right, good. So given that, then I think we're going to send you off again to discuss this, I assume primarily with the governor's office, former Craig Campbell and others.
We had some initial discussions with the governor's office. We think he's a little more comfortable now that he understands the issue a little better.
Right.
And we'd be more than happy to do that, Mr. Chair, and we'd be happy to work with your counsel as well.
All right. If I understand correctly, the intent would be to narrow it to the State Department of Corrections and exclude cities and counties. Correct.
And the state police evidently have some concerns as well. It's not...
All right.
You know,
all right.
Sometimes you can't save the world. You just got to fix your corner.
Well, that's true. This is about compromise.
I need to make
Mr. Snyder, are you happy with that? All right, good. You reserve the right to object. Ms. Monson, same thing? All right, thank you. Then we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 620, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 683. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. And for the committee, you have a copy of a couple of cases relevant to the 620 bill, the Garrity bill and an Oregon case, John Graff, for your reading pleasure. All righty, who do we have here? Kathleen, I guess we're a subcommittee now, looks like. Where did everybody go? Kathleen, hold on just a second. We'll wait till we get a committee back in the room. They seem to have disappeared on me. So, is this your first time to the legislature?
This is my first time before a legislative committee, yes.
All right.
It's not my first time visiting here. A little background. I helped Senator Durfler in his freshman campaign. I worked for him then. So
oh, is that right?
Worked from the staff offices.
I see. Okay.
And in a prior career, I was a budget analyst with the executive department.
Oh, all right.
I'm a realtor now.
So you have some government experience.
I have a little government experience. This has been I've enjoyed the discussion, the issues, and how you've dealt with them this morning.
All right. Well, thank you. Let me kind of direct you back to your testimony on 683, if you can, since we do now have a quorum, go ahead and begin your testimony on that bill. Appreciate it.
Are we ready?
We are ready.
I'm Kathleen Diwana. I'm an associate broker with Coldwell Banker Mountain West Real Estate, Inc. My owner-manager broker, Peter Rogers, asked me to bring this proposal before you. Senate Bill 683 creates an incentive for sellers to be reasonable when a sale agreement falls apart and an earnest money should be returned to a buyer. When we create an earnest money agreement or a sale agreement, that's the beginning of a contractual process. And in that contractual process, to protect the buyer, we put in quite a few contingencies and to protect the seller as well. When we start in the process of buying a home, we obviously have to get the buyer qualified, make sure the financing works. We also go through a fairly rigorous procedure to discover and disclose everything we can about the condition of the property and its relative value in the marketplace. Our sale agreements are fairly straightforward in how we proceed and under what conditions an earnest money should be refunded to a buyer or released to the seller. And in a few incidences, we get sellers who, quite frankly, just refuse to sign the termination and release of the earnest money. What the buyer then has to do is go to small claims court to get a release of the earnest money. A lot of buyers do not have a lot of money that they can leave a trail behind in earnest money agreements or have a lot of money to roll for inspections and research on property. So expediting the release of that earnest money to the buyer, if it is reasonable according to the terms of the contract, is extremely helpful. What I also found very recently when I had to help a buyer to initiate an action with small claims court was that small claims court in Marion County were so backed up that, and we started this process in January, that they really didn't think they would be able to handle us until July, and in fact referred us to three justice courts, and we pursued with those justice courts and found we had no jurisdiction in any of them. So with this proposal, my broker, Peter Rogers, came out of California, and he said in California courts there were lots and lots of issues where sellers simply refused to release the earnest money through the mutual release and had lots of cases backed up in small claims court. He said basically if you provide in law that if the earnest money is unreasonably withheld by the seller, that the buyer can recover three times that earnest money as damages, we won't see those cases in small claims court. Our sellers become infinitely reasonable. I think legislative counsel did an excellent job of drafting this bill. It seems very clear. It's about two statements, one of policy and one of an opportunity to recover damages. This bill really is protecting the buyers that do not have a lot of money and giving them an opportunity when the conditions of the property cannot be satisfied to move on and go buy another home. So I'd appreciate your help.
Well, help me understand, what does unreasonably refuse mean in the bill?
What would be unreasonably refusing to sign it? Well, if we can go through our contract and spell out pretty clearly that the buyer is terminating this because we couldn't negotiate the condition of the property, or the property couldn't qualify, or there are issues on the title that cannot be resolved in the time frame allowed, the buyer can walk. Okay, if it's perfectly clear that we have reserved a contingency and the contract instructs us to release the earnest money to the buyer, but the seller won't sign the mutual release just because he just doesn't want to sign the mutual release, he doesn't care about the buyer or their money at this point, that would be unreasonable.
All right. Other questions?
Yeah.
Senator Walker, Senator Brady.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. DeWan, I have two questions. When you deposit money into as part of an earnest money agreement, doesn't it go into an escrow account?
It goes to an escrow account with the title company. And in order to get a release of that escrow from the title company, we have to have the signed mutual release by both the seller and the buyer.
I see. Then the second question is, you mentioned California is backed up and they're small claims court. What about Oregon? I mean, this is specific to Oregon, so how often do you see this in Oregon?
You know, from my perspective, I'm one agent, one broker. My managing broker will see it 200 times as frequently as I do. I see, you know, at least not frequently, one every couple of years where I get an unreasonable party. So if you multiply me by the 800 or so brokers in the state of Oregon, you can get sort of a feel for a potential of issues around earnest monies. It doesn't happen frequently, but the damage that is done to a buyer that can't roll their earnest money too many times and can't roll their inspection dollars too many times is significant.
And thank you. I had one other question that came up, Mr. Chair, if I might.
Sure.
Ms. DeWanna, do you belong to a professional association, and if so, has that association taken a position on this bill?
I am a member of the Salem Association of Realtors and the Oregon Association of Realtors and the National Association of Realtors. I guess I'm a member of all of those. And no, they have not taken a position on this bill.
Okay, thank you.
Is that to your knowledge?
To my knowledge.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Brady.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to follow up on Senator Walker's first question. The money, if the seller is being unreasonable, doesn't sign the mutual release agreement, the money stays with the title company. Why would the seller refuse to sign? If I hear you saying, the seller can't get access to that money.
No, sometimes they just choose not to. Okay.
So what reason would they possibly have?
It certainly is. They just don't want to. There's not a reason. It is unreasonable.
Can you cite a specific example to us?
I did have one example of my own.
Without mentioning names, of course.
Without mentioning names, in which I had a young first-time buyer. We shopped for homes. We wrote a sale agreement. We started our inspections on the property, and our inspections are fairly thorough. In fact, in this case, the seller had provided a full home inspection, and we followed up with professional inspections from electricians, plumbers, and chimney contractors and structural contractors, and we found that we were in a situation in which the cost to repair damages that were discovered were really too much for the buyer to bear, and the seller was adamant about feeling that she wanted to sell the property in as-is condition, and we had we terminated the sale agreement within the period allowed for inspections under the sale agreement, and the seller was angry and just refused to sign the mutual release.
Well, wouldn't you normally write the earnest money agreement so that you would include those contingencies, that the purchase is contingent upon inspections?
Absolutely. And again, even though the contract and performance of the contract has happened, we can't get the money out of the title company, out of escrow, without the signed mutual release.
Right.
The mutual release.
I see. All right. The title company imposes is what the council is telling me.
Yes. Yes.
All right. Well, why don't you stand down and let's. I guess we do have another question here, Senator Farioli.
No, I have a whole bunch of issues about this bill, Mr. Chairman. The first thing that occurs to me is that the whole concept of liquidated damages is built into the earnest money concept. There is no standard amount of earnest money. It's negotiated between the buyer and the seller. So the agents take great pains to advise the purchaser, potential purchaser, that whatever they offer as earnest money potentially is forfeit if they fail to perform. So there's this, you know, it's basically the beginning of this minuet that goes on between the buyer and the seller. And the seller has to accept the amount of earnest money and the total purchase price. But usually the seller also has to accept a whole bunch of contingency clauses. When I was a real estate broker, we used to call them weasel clauses. And, you know, that could be the loan, the condition of the property, the performance by specific dates. I mean, there's a flock of different contingencies. as unique as each individual property would be. During the period of time when these contingencies are being met, the seller essentially is off the market with the property. So, you know, there is benefits and protections for both the buyer and the seller with contingency clauses and the concept of liquidated damages for failure to perform. But this bill presents a whole bunch of logistical nightmares. For instance, an earnest money is made, it doesn't matter what the amount is. Is the broker now going to have to require that the seller deposits three times the amount in some kind of a client's trust account? No. But how is the broker going to be involved in assuring that the purchaser's rights are protected in a case that would possibly relate to triple damages? You know, does the broker have some sort of liability? I would just suggest that this whole concept of earnest money, contingency clauses, and liquidated damages for failure to perform has evolved in the real estate business over 100 years. And to just suggest that a triple damages clause somehow balances the equation assumes that it's out of balance. And I'm not persuaded at all that that it is out of balance, first of all, because the amount of the earnest money is a matter of negotiation between the buyer and the seller. And the buyer is always advised that potentially their failure to perform could relate in or could result in forfeiture of the earnest money. That is central to the transaction. The idea that the seller's weasel clauses or conditional clauses could create this triple liability on the part of the seller just seems illogical. And there may be cases where sellers are recalcitrant, and in that case, it's actionable.
Let me ask you a question, Senator, because I've bought a few properties before, but generally you offer earnest money and an earnest money agreement to a prospective seller. The seller accepts the conditions and those so-called easel clauses. That becomes then, I assume, a contract. So it's not as if the purchaser is the only person who's playing ball in that game, because if I understand correctly, the seller can then counter and say, no, I won't accept that contingency. In fact, here's what I'll accept in terms of price, earnest money, whatever else. And ultimately, there's an agreement and there's movement towards the conclusion of what's believed to be a successful sale. Then I'm assuming something occurs in the process. The bill says, through no fault of the buyer. So that then assumes that there's something that occurs on the seller's end of it that creates this inability for the contract to close. Either the value of the property was not as stated, it didn't appraise out to the level that it should have or would have, or some other reason. So I got to help me understand where you're going with that.
Okay, here's the crux of the issue, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for asking to clarify a difficult question. Frequently, buyers will suffer a condition called buyer's remorse. Either in the market for a property, they might be looking at half a dozen different properties, and they decide to go ahead and make an offer on one. For whatever reason, for their own personal reasons, they decide that they really want the sale to fail. They really want out of the deal. Maybe they found a different property that's slightly better for their needs or a better price or some other condition. I don't see any protection here for an intentional sale fail caused by the buyer related to one of the contingencies that they've written for the clauses. They refuse to accept a report from some inspector. Now, that's no fault of the buyer. You know, the property didn't qualify. And so, in the case of buyer's remorse, what's the protection for the seller that they won't be held liable for the triple damages in those cases where people just get cold feet and want to walk?
Mr. Chair, frankly, this is getting off the subject of the bill, but I think in that case, the buyer would be sued. For one thing, they lose their earnest money. It's gone. I mean, that's not what this woman is trying to address. She's trying to address where the earnest money is held in limbo indefinitely. And I don't see that in support of the bill, frankly, I think there already are some issues, but I think with respect to Senator Ferriola, that's getting to be a different issue.
Right. Okay. Do you want to make some closing remarks here, and then we'll get the realtors group. I think Oregon Associated Realtors had some comments here, signed up against the bill. So,
if Mike may address Senator Ferriello's concern about the buyer's remorse situation in the course of a real estate contract and performance of that, if we have satisfied all the buyer's contingencies, we do so in writing. And when we've met those contingencies, then if a buyer chooses to walk after they were able to, the lender provided the loan, all of the conditions of the property were accepted, then yes, indeed, the seller is entitled to that earnest money. And I've had those situations also. What this one addresses is where the seller just plain refuses to sign the earnest money, leaves it in limbo, and the buyer is harmed.
Mr. Chairman, in that exact situation, that exact fact set, doesn't the purchaser have legal recourse now?
Pardon me?
The purchaser has legal recourse now, isn't
that? The recourse is good to go into small claims court, and the delay in the process, or even the lack of ability to have process happen in small claims court that harms them. Okay, some of our buyers have just enough money to purchase their first home, and it's a small amount of money sometimes, $3,000 perhaps. So $1,000 earnest money held up can hold them up for a long time unnecessarily.
All right, let me get the realtors on, and you can hear what they have to say, the State Association. Matt Farmer.
Chairman, as members of the committee, Matt Farmer, Associate General Counsel for Oregon Association of Realtors. There's about 13,000 realtors in the state of Oregon. They represent both buyers and sellers. We oppose this bill because it's asymmetrical. Our members represent sellers. They represent buyers. The problem here is earnest money disputes, and that is a concern. It's something we've been working with the real estate agency on to try and improve the process by which these disputes are resolved. In other words, to expedite the process, which is actually the problem and a legitimate one. This bill doesn't reach that. Instead, it intends to put a heavy thumb on one side of the equation. And in situations that frankly rarely exist, and when they do exist, they typically exist on the buyer's side. Let me explain. When earnest money is disputed, and if you look at the first clause of the bill, you can see the embedding of the dispute. There it says that when through no fault of the buyer. Through no fault of the buyer is a factual issue, and believe me, that is what is being resolved in an earnest money dispute. The buyer believes they have met the terms of some contingency. The seller believes that that's not true. That is the typical dispute. Those disputes are difficult contract interpretation and factual issues. They are so difficult, in fact, that one of the big problems, and I think the problem that really underlies this and is not addressed by this bill, is that until very recently, most brokers held a client's trust account in which the earnest money stayed. And so that money was then within the control of the broker. Typically, that would be the buyer's broker would hold a client trust account. The money would be deposited there. If the deal then fell apart, it was within the broker's control to say, oh, well, this was through no fault of my client, and therefore I'm giving the money back to them. Or my client breached the contract, and therefore, under the terms of the agreement, the money goes to the seller. That was the broker's choice. Because of the litigious nature of our society, brokers started getting named in those disputes where they maybe thought it was reasonable that it wouldn't go one place or go the other. but the person against whom they decided didn't think it was reasonable would drag them into court. And so the upshot of that is that brokers, and my guess is the company that is pushing this is one of them, have started closing their client trust accounts. Because they don't have client trust accounts, then the money goes directly into escrow. Because it goes into escrow, it's held by a neutral. Because it's held by a neutral, the neutral cannot distribute the money except by mutual agreement. That's what the mutual release thing is about. So brokers have it within their power to fix this, and that's what we're working with the real estate agency on, is to try and get an expedited procedure that gets that decision made. If that's not possible and the money's already in escrow, the case is split on who's entitled to it all over the place, and very rarely will someone who has no legitimate legal claim to the money at all actually refuse to release the money. The reason they're not releasing it is that they think they have a legitimate claim to it. Where you see unreasonable releases, where somebody just says, yeah, I know that I can't get the money, but I just don't want them to happen, actually, buyers do that more than sellers for a very simple reason. It's their money. They've breached the contract. They pledged it to the seller for performance of the contract, they now say, well, I'm not going to just sign it away to him. He has to come and get it. So the bill is asymmetrical. It's backwards. What it's going to do is create a bounty to actually intensify the number of earnest money disputes. What we want to see happen, and we're certainly working in this direction and have been, is to find some way to expedite the determination of who's entitled to earnest money. We think that will take care of these rare instances in which somebody actually unreasonably refuses. As it's written, all we get to do is hire lawyers to argue about what's reasonable and what isn't and create a bounty for that argument. I don't think that's good law.
All right. Any questions?
Just two really quick questions.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Farmer, two things. One, you said this is rare, a rare instance that this occurs, and the previous witness indicated she had maybe one to two every couple of years. So tell me exactly how rare it is, and then you said you're working on getting an expedited procedure to deal with this, and who's working on it?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, one of my duties with the association is to answer in the mornings, and obviously I'm not there this morning, a legal hotline that is extended to real estate brokers across the state. And so judging from that, and I've been doing that now for about 5 years, so I will get a dozen or so calls involving real estate problems a day, 5 days a week for 5 years. Based on that, earnest money disputes where two people honestly believe they're entitled to earnest money is fairly common. A situation where it's clear that the money by contract goes one place or the other, but the other person, for spite, simply refuses to sign the release. I can think of two or three times in that 5 years where I might have believed that was the case, where the contesting the earnest money was not in good faith, was purely for spite. Current law, of course, will deal with that. The problem is that it takes time to do it, and that's what we're interested in, is expediting it. To your second question, Senator Walker, we have proposed rule changes to the real estate agency that would expedite the process of getting money out of a client's trust account should there be a dispute, and take the broker out of the middle of it. And we believe that if that's the case, then brokers would be more willing to have these accounts. If they had the accounts, then that rare occasion could be handled as a contract professional issue rather than as a legal issue.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that response.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, we're going to close the public hearing, and we are adjourned.